Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. It is terrific to have you all here tonight. We are going to be getting started in just a little while. Kaya Grossberg, author of Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs, is going to be on Talk with Penny tonight. I am setting up shows for the new year, so if you are wanting to call in, please do, and we will get things rolling in just a couple of minutes. I think that Kaya is on with us live now. Kaya?
Hi.
Hi, how are you? Welcome to Talk
with Penny. Hi, good to see you. Yeah, it's great to hear your voice. Thank you for having me on here.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on. I was just setting up the show and letting people know that you are going to be discussing your work consulting with people coming off of psychiatric drugs. You've been doing this for over 15 years now. I'm so excited to hear what you are up to. Just as a reminder, none of this is medical advice. I'm really excited to learn the wisdom that you've gained from these 15 years of professional experience of working with people non-medically and seeking a variety of alternatives to the mainstream psychiatric paradigm. So, Kaya, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I know that you've been working in this realm for a very long time as well. And, you know, things change over time, but some things don't change that much in terms of what people are grappling with, you know, in the mental health system.
Definitely. Sometimes I was locked up in 1988 when I was 15. I'm 49 now. And I think in some ways it's more pervasive now than it was then. And certainly when we trail back to the 1840s, we can see exactly how much more pervasive it is, but how from the beginning this was designed to be a system of control and force. And that was their words. Fascinated to hear what you've been up to, and maybe trail people back 15 or 20 years ago to where your work starts so that they can really contextualize what you have done, which is a phenomenal amount. So sure. I appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Endeavor, let's say, into the mental health system started with my own experiences back in the 90s. And fast forward into the early 2000s was when I was nearly killed by psychiatric pharmaceuticals and happened to be living in Northampton, Massachusetts, where I connected with the Freedom Center, which was an activist and support group for people who had been harmed by psychiatry or who were looking for alternatives to psychiatry. So it felt definitely like a fated encounter situation, because while I was recovering from pharmaceutical harm, I was living right around the corner from these meetings where other people were gathering to talk about such things at a time where we were probably one of only a handful of groups in the entire world that might have been doing such a thing, if there were even any others, back in around 2002 or so. So that was definitely how I got started with activism and with sharing my story publicly. I mean, I was always a writer, so I always, you know, sought to write about my experiences and make meaning that way, or find meaning or understand what had happened. So I started doing a lot of public speaking and, you know, did some work. I did some work with offering alternatives to the psychiatric paradigm. And I taught yoga for the Freedom Center and started a writing group with the Freedom Center. And then we, in Massachusetts, eventually started the Recovery Learning Community, which was funded by the state, but also had a lot of peer support and alternatives. And then in the later 2010s, in the later, I don't know how to say it. Around 2009, let's say, I moved to the West Coast and started some other work where I worked with the Alternative to Meds Center, which is a place that helps people who are coming off psychiatric medications, and had several other jobs offering alternatives to psychiatry, and at a certain point decided to start my own consulting business and did a lot of blogging on my own blog and on Mad in America, especially as a way of reaching out to share my thoughts and experiences around psychiatry. So that's just, you know, a brief description of how I got involved in all of this.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's amazing to see how over the years you really were able to use the social media and other platforms in order to get your word out and share your ideas with people. And I, if you have any suggestions for people who are trying to do the same in terms of setting up their own space, like we've talked about before, and how you actually became a consultant and started to really be a support to people, if you want to add any of that as you're going along too. But I'm wondering, would you be willing to talk a little bit about your book, Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I think that in a way, you know, like I said, I've always been a writer. So that's been like my main outlet throughout my life, starting in childhood even. So even while I was going through all of these things with psychiatry before and after, I was writing about it. And the opportunity to blog on Mad in America was really important for me because it gave me an audience of people who were actively interested in this topic. I mean, what I've noticed is that most people are actually actively interested in this topic in general. Most people are affected by psychiatry or someone very close to them is. I've never really met anyone who doesn't have any feelings, opinions, or experiences with psychiatry and just has no opinion or feeling about it. So it's become very mainstream, obviously, for people to be affected by it, unfortunately. But so I had been writing about all of these different things, and at a certain point I really wanted to compile my writings into a book, into an organized sort of manual that people could access. And also I ended up making a workbook sections at the end of each chapter of my book so that people could use the book as a way to explore their own experiences and reflect on what they were going through and how they wanted to approach it. So it's been really great to have finished my book. You know, it was definitely a long process of writing it and editing it and organizing it and finishing it, and then starting to get it out there. So pretty soon after I finished my book, I moved back to the East Coast. So I was on the West Coast for 10 years, and then I moved back here to Massachusetts, which was actually really nice because I was able to do some book events here before things shut down and had people here, you know, who were familiar with my work from back in the Freedom Center days and in the early 2000s when, you know, they had come to Freedom Center yoga classes and events and, you know, speak outs and talks and all kinds of things. So there are definitely a lot of people here in Western Massachusetts who are aware of this topic because of how active it has been here for such a long time with activists. Whereas I noticed, you know, when I was on the West Coast, there were places where there was less awareness and less involvement. So, did you want to say something or ask something?
It's interesting that that's the experience. I think I've heard that from others also, and it always surprises me because it, you know, we're trained that the West Coast is much more based in alternative kinds of ways of thinking, and so it always surprises me that there's really not a vibrant alternative movement in
It's interesting because I think on the West Coast there's already a lot of alternative mindset, even more so. I mean, I think it's starting to change because with the level of communications that people have with everyone now that like people are on the internet like 24/7, basically, it's, I think the cultures are starting to become less different, but something I did feel was that on the West Coast, there are so many alternative health people that alternatives to psychiatry isn't as much of like a, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for, but it's like, it's not as much of a confrontation because there's not as much, it's not as intense as the East, like the East Coast tends to be more medical model and the average person tends to believe in the medical model more. Whereas on the West Coast, I mean, of course, you know, there's a variety of different people everywhere. So, but I just think that Western Massachusetts is kind of specifically has this history with the Freedom Center and other activist groups of being like extremely involved in the psychiatric survivor movement. Like certain parts of it really were born here in Western Massachusetts. And I definitely found things, you know, in San Francisco and Portland, Oregon. In Olympia, Washington, though, there really wasn't anything. And I had to start things kind of from scratch. There was no activist community around alternatives to psychiatry. But of course, there were so many people that had the same experiences. It was just that they didn't have any organization yet.
So I'm just wondering, for people who may be tuning in and stumbling over this and being like, what is this about? Why do people need freedom from psychiatric drugs? Like what could you from your, I mean, I know why from my perspective, but could you talk why from your perspective of some of the things that both you've experienced that you mentioned briefly, but also that maybe you've encountered from other people's experiences broadly about.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Why
yes,
the motivation
absolutely.
And what would freedom, what causes the non-freedom and what would freedom mean?
That's a great question. So I think the non-freedom is that a lot of people get put on psychiatric drugs without really being educated about how hard it is to get off of them and or what the potential downsides of them are. So often when people get put on them, they're either young and don't really know exactly what's going on with the drugs, or they are going through some kind of really intense crisis and either them or people around them are in a panic state. So it's like there's this sense of using the psychiatric drugs as an emergency solution or an emergency, even like a kind of urgent Band-Aid situation to prevent things from spiraling out of control. So that often happens, but the problem is that people often don't get taken off of them safely. And most psychiatrists don't even know how to take someone off them safely and don't even really have a motivation to or a really clear goal to take somebody off of the medications. So the other thing is, of course, that then people can start to identify with a diagnosis that they often receive when they're going through some kind of acute stressful situation, and then believing in that diagnosis is also something that can trap somebody into feeling like either feeling like they need these medications or being scared to come off of them. But the other element that people have trouble with is the actual withdrawal itself. And that's something that most of my clients are dealing with is actually having trouble dealing with the withdrawal symptoms. But sometimes it's also wound up in like a fear of coming off the drugs, especially if somebody has been on them for a long time or if they've been told that they need them and that they have a certain illness that requires them for life. Or, you know, even like with all the information that's known about the lack of science in psychiatric diagnosis, it's a little tricky how the media and the pharmaceutical industry still manage to propagate dishonest information. And if people hear something enough times, they often will end up still believing it, even if there's no logic or science behind it. So those are some of the things. Oh, go ahead.
Right. No. Right. I mean, and are conditioned through the industries to do so. Definitely. You mentioned withdrawal from the drugs, and people are routinely told that there is no, that there will be no withdrawal because there's no thing that causes any kind of addiction or dependence to the drug. But you're saying that people are, in your experience, people struggle with the withdrawal.
Definitely. And, you know, I think that's why so many people reach out to me in desperation, because they're having withdrawal. And, you know, at this point, there's definitely enough information on the internet that people have access to. I personally didn't have access to knowledge or information about withdrawal when I was going through this in like 2002, because the internet really wasn't very vibrant yet. And there weren't a lot of people sharing their own experiences on the internet really at all. Or even in books, you know, there was very little information out there about withdrawal. So for me, I went through withdrawal, and it took me several times of not even knowing it was withdrawal, which caused so many more problems, because then people can get a further more serious diagnosis, get put on more medication and all kinds of things when they have withdrawal symptoms. But now, you know, more people know about withdrawal and more people are aware of it, such that even if their doctor denies it, they usually still know that they're experiencing withdrawal a lot of the time. I mean, at least the people that come to me, because those who come to me are specifically coming to me because they want to come off psychiatric drugs, or even if it.
Right. So what I'm saying is I agree that most people understand that there's more information now from survivors about the fact that there is a withdrawal, that there's a withdrawal process, that there's a way to avoid going through the withdrawal as in those kinds of things. But most doctors still currently deny the fact that there is any issue with withdrawal, and actually say that you have to stay on the drug forever anyway, so that there would be no withdrawal because you would not be off the drug, right? Can you explain to somebody who doesn't know about the withdrawal, who isn't on these drugs, who may be you know, just having general information from what they get from the pharmaceutical industries, from the psychiatric industries, organized psychiatry generally, what is the withdrawal process? Like what actually happens? What do people talk about experiencing?
Yeah, good question. So people experience a very wide range of withdrawal symptoms. Some of them, you know, and it can really vary from person to person. Some people don't experience them that badly, and it depends how long they were on the drug, et cetera, but, and what they're on and how high the dose is and everything. But some of the things people will experience that I also did are things like panic and anxiety, akathisia, which is, you know, when you feel like you can't stop moving or like kind of jumping out of your skin, and extreme exhaustion, sometimes loss of appetite or nausea, sometimes suicidal feelings or thoughts, extreme despair, or all kinds of sort of physiological types of panic and anxiety. I think that's a really big one. Or the other one that comes up a lot is a sense of like what could be called psychosis, where it's like somebody sort of loses control of their mind, but it's more of a chemical induced withdrawal state versus like anything that's actually going on in their life causing it. It's more the withdrawal itself that can cause, I guess what could be called a psychotic state of mind, where the mind is like it's kind of like a bad trip or something, where somebody just can't really get a grasp on their mind, but it's temporary. So that's good.
but that's one of the places of where people wind up getting diagnosed with a more, you know,
right.
In terms of
yeah.
severity of diagnosis, that's partially what happens, right? And so,
and it can be very scary, you know, those things can all be very scary for people, especially if they don't really understand that it's withdrawal. But even if they do understand, sometimes there's still a lot of fear of like, will this be like that forever? Is this an underlying condition? How long will it last? Things like that.
So I imagine that the response that you have has to be as individualized as the people that you're working with. But generally, could you talk a little bit about what the process is like? and what you learned from this work that you do?
Yeah, definitely. So do you mean the process of withdrawal or the process of working with people?
The process of like, what if somebody is going through this, and like, what are, because I know, like, when I came off psychiatric drugs, I went cold turkey. It was long before anything about titration ever came down. It was horrible and horrifying, and really, I would never suggest that anybody do that. The bottom line, like, I feel like, and that informs consent throughout the whole process is the most crucial pieces of it. But you've worked with so many people who have had such, I'm sure, different experiences of going through this.
Yeah.
What is it that people could expect if they were interacting with you in this kind of way?
Yeah. So the first thing that I would do is ask the person some questions, listen to their story. So that's like a really important part of it, is listening to somebody's story, because that's something that a lot of people haven't truly had, is somebody who can listen to their story without a focus on diagnosis, you know, or prescriptions. So listening to somebody's story and like understanding everything that they've been through helps a lot, because like, after hearing so many stories, it's easy for me to see the patterns and see very quickly, like, what is going on, what questions I need to ask, like, what's their lifestyle, what's their diet like, who's in their life, you know, do they have support or not? So I look at the whole picture and then assess, like, well, what needs to happen first, second, and third? So, you know, sometimes the first thing that we need to focus on is someone's diet, or sometimes when somebody comes to me, they're already in the process of withdrawal. So usually, because at this point there is a lot of information out there, so people have done a lot of their own research most of the time, and they do have, most people have the knowledge that they need to withdraw slowly. So that's really good. So most people are already on a sort of slow taper plan when they reach out to me, but if they're not, then I can also help them to create that kind of slow plan where they're, you know, reducing by a small amount every few weeks or so and seeing how they feel. And then if it gets to be too much, they can go back up a little bit and go slower. So that's usually the approach that I take. But first, it's really important to make sure that somebody has a good diet, because eating well and having enough nourishment is like one of the most important things to help somebody stay as stable as possible. And then, of course, helping if they need help with things like sleep. So just like kind of starting with the most fundamental basics, because even though you wouldn't think that things like that would have a huge impact, they actually have more of an impact than almost anything else, you know? So it's interesting how a lot of times a therapist might focus on like someone's childhood or even their emotions and things like that, which is great. But in terms of withdrawal, it's important to also be practical, like making sure that somebody is eating well and consistently, because, you know, sometimes when people are going through these things, it's hard to even eat normally or enough, because there's so much anxiety and fear and distractions and like overwhelm that even just basic things like eating and sleeping can go by the wayside. So I always focus on those things first. And usually, you know, I mean, in terms of the people that reach out to me, some of them already have a really great plan. Like they already eat really well. They have like really stable habits and good sleep and things like that. So they're already really on a good track. And then some people need more support in those areas. And there are certain supplements and certain herbs and things like protein powder and amino acids that I often recommend to people if they need more support, like if they're having trouble with the physiological effects of withdrawal, because supporting the body, like giving the body some extra nutrition, can make a difference.
I think that there's definitely something to be said for nutrition and sleep in terms of the general space regularly. And then when, I mean, I'm just kind of wondering, like, if there's another whole, like, kind of psychological, and for lack of a better term, not like psychological in terms of diagnosis, but like psychological in terms of like
space, yeah,
of space of where people are really dependent on the messages that they get from psychiatry, which can be very oppressive.
Yes.
And like, do you find that the what people have been told about themselves gears them? And are there ways to like re-message?
Yes, definitely. So that is another big thing that I do with people, is to understand like, where are they coming from? What mindset do they have, and what have they been told, and how much do they believe it? And just also like what the person's strengths are, because oftentimes when somebody gets a diagnosis, they might be going through some kind of crisis or extremely stressful time, or even like a spiritual emergence of some kind. So it's important to recognize what the person's strengths are, like what are their interests, what are their passions, hobbies, you know, who are their friends, what are things that we can build on, you know, because a lot of times if somebody's been labeled as a mental patient, it's like there's a lot of, kind of like hiding and even shame or fear, but also like a sense of losing the self-worth and self-value, and even losing the recognition that one might have of what their gifts are, what they have to offer. You know, another thing is that most people that I talk to actually really want to help other people to come off psychiatric drugs once they're done with the process. And a lot of people that I talk to, a lot of people I talk to, you know, have really incredible gifts that may have been repressed because of these diagnoses, or even because of the medications themselves. Like, for example, if somebody is a writer or an artist, sometimes the medications can suppress their creativity or their ability to think or write. I mean, that happened to me actually as well. When I was on 7 different medications, I couldn't really write or think clearly for the most part. So it was in a lot of ways suppressing, you know, something that was essential to me as a human being in living my life with integrity and with my sense of purpose. So, and that's often common for people, is like the lethargy and apathy that can be caused by psychiatric drugs can make somebody lose a sense of like why they're even here or what they're doing, or, you know, how they can overcome this. And even just like a sense of totally like, why am I even here? What's the point? I mean, sorry if this is tangential, but I was just trying to say that it is extremely important to recognize, you know, what someone's mindset is and how to kind of find who they really are and what their real gifts are that might have been denied through this process.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's I think crucial for people to understand who are listening about this, and the ways that people's natural selves are sliced and torn by psychiatry and diminished for what their natural skills and talents are. And very often those things can be turned into then things that get psychiatrized themselves. I'm wondering, I get calls all the time for people looking for support groups other people who are going through it. Are there any support groups that people could participate in via the internet or other spaces that you know of that you would suggest to people? Do they exist anywhere?
That's a great question. I think, you know, that locally it's a little tricky right now with all of the restrictions. I do think that there might be certain support groups, you know, locally here in Western Massachusetts, but they're not necessarily, specifically for coming off psychiatric medications. I do think that there are some online forums that can help people to find peer support buddies, who can then be like a person that they could actually talk to one-on-one or in a group perhaps. I think that the Laura Delano's website, the Inner Compass Initiative, has, I think, you know, ways that people can meet one another. Is that noise like somebody calling in or something?
There are some people online. There's a couple of people who are online waiting, so that might be what you're hearing. Another person just came in, so we can try to see if I can open up lines and see if anybody wants to jump in and ask questions.
Can I just say one more thing, though, in answer to that question? Sure. I just want to add one more thing. Okay, thanks. I just wanted to say, though, that something that I've been thinking about, I put out a feeler for this, and we'll see, you know, if people are interested or not, but is to create a buddy system within my work where I can work with two people who are also working together with each other. That's an idea that recently I've been, you know, fleshing out, and I'm still in the process of seeing if this is something that people I work with are actively interested in. But I just wanted to put that out there as something I've been working with. And, you know, I've done a lot of support groups over the years, you know, both virtually, on the phone, in person. And I guess leading a support group isn't something I'm really feeling drawn to right now, but I do think that it's really important, especially in person, you know, because those groups can really help people. But at the same time, like, a large group can also, it's hard to facilitate a support group like that, and it can often bring up a lot of stuff, which is why I feel drawn to facilitate like a two-person kind of peer support situation, because it feels more manageable to me. And I think that sometimes when people are going through withdrawal, being in a whole room full of other people who are can get overwhelming. So I'm just putting that out there. But obviously everyone, you know, has different things that they benefit from.
It's an interesting premise, because I think that people really are seeking connection, and those natural connections are really hard to find naturally these days, because of all the restrictions.
I know.
I do think that would be something that I would be really interested in hearing a follow-up from you about, whether or not you have anything. And then if you do find anything, if you would tag me in it as it's coming into being, that would be terrific. Sure. And also, do you want to give out your information so that people can, if they, you know, for those of you just tuning in, we are talking with Kaya Grossberg, the author of Alternatives, Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs, and who offers alternatives to psychiatry as a consultant. Kaya, your website is kayagrossberg.com?
Yes. Yeah. And the book is called Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs. So it comes up right away, you know, if you Google that. What is that? It's on Amazon, the book.
Yes, and there are links in the show description to it and to your website also, which is terrific. And the book is 15 years already? Is that right?
The book is 15 years what?
How the book was published 15 years ago, is that?
Oh, no, I just published this book a few years ago, but I was probably writing it for about 15 years.
Okay. All right, great. I'm so excited for you. I want to see if I can open up these lines. Area code 416, your line is open. Do you have any questions or comments?
Not right now. I'm just listening to everyone else's input. The questions I have is more of a very, how would you say it, step-by-step question, like in actually experiences of others and coming off of them who are going through severe stress, and what do they do to help alleviate that? And I read somewhere that a few of them would try magnesium supplements, but these made them more anxious, and I don't understand why.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure what type of magnesium they took, but magnesium is a tricky one because sometimes it can cause the detox process to happen faster, which can make withdrawal symptoms worse. So yeah, magnesium can be tricky. Some people find it helpful, but some don't. So I would just be careful with that. I agree with what you're saying. I mean, there are other ways, like Epsom salt baths or topical magnesium, that would be safer also than oral supplements.
Oh, yes? Okay. All right. I have to look into that.
Okay. What's that?
I'll have to take a, I have to look into that. Is it more like herbs? That's what you're thinking about?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, there is, you know, one of the herbs that I recommend a lot is oat straw. And that one is pretty high in magnesium and calcium. It's very calming. And that won't cause any of those side effects with the magnesium. So I would definitely recommend that one. And Tulsi is another good one. It's not high in magnesium, but it's very calming.
Okay.
So there are ways to get those calming effects without taking oral magnesium supplements. And again, you could try an Epsom salt bath or trying to eat foods that are high in magnesium, because that won't cause that kind of intensive detox reaction that the supplements will cause.
Oh, okay. But any of people have tried niacin? Is niacin one of their... I've always read about that by Hoffer.
Yes. You've read what?
That Hoffer, like, speaks about it quite a bit. Is that a successful way of doing it?
That is a great question. So niacin is like this whole other world. I should say I'm not like an extreme expert on niacin, but I have done some research about it. And for some people, it is like a miracle supplement with this. I haven't heard of any really bad problems with niacin in coming off psychiatric medications, although I don't think it's as common for people to try it because it's just not as well known about as things like magnesium. But again, with niacin, it's like the range of how much people take is very wide. So, you know, like the dosages and some niacin, there's like the kind of niacin that makes you flush and the kind that doesn't. So the kind that makes you flush, you know, creates this kind of flush when you take enough of it, where it can create like a heat in the body and a detox reaction that some people are fine with, you know, and it's like a sign that it's working. So I think niacin is a really good, it's a good one to try, you know, and even if you take a low dose of it or don't take the flushing kind, it can be really calming and helpful. So I think with niacin, a lot is about the dosage and which kind you take. And, you know, there are Facebook groups about niacin where people are really experts on the niacin thing. So I think that I would recommend, you know, doing some research about niacin, but also I think it's pretty safe to try it at a low dose.
A low dose. Okay.
And so, of course, this isn't medical, but I want to just underscore, this isn't medical advice and there's a space inside of this of where, like, that this is for informational purposes, not for, like, activity purposes, right?
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, I'm not an expert on niacin, so this is definitely not medical.
Okay.
So I am curious though, Kaya, you mentioned that there were some foods that were rich in magnesium, and I'm curious as to which they might be. Do you know off the top of your head by chance?
Yes, I do. There's one, this isn't exactly a regular food, but there's one that I actually take that's rice bran powder, and that is very high in magnesium. Things like rice bran and wheat bran, and then leafy greens, especially cooked leafy greens, and are good. And then dark chocolate, any green vegetables, especially cooked ones. And then nuts are high in magnesium, especially cashews. What else? Those are the first ones that come to my mind.
Okay.
I'm sure there are a lot of others, though, and that, you know, the other thing is we really always, of course, can do our own research and find more information about things like that. But those are the first ones that I think of. Almonds are pretty good as well.
That's interesting. Thanks. Great. Interesting question. Thank you. Thank you for calling in. Do you have other questions that you're...
No, that's...
No, thank you so much. I hope you have a wonderful night.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling.
All right. Bye.
So I think that's any place where we can find these kinds of things naturally inside of food, that's an interesting space. And I was not aware of that about magnesium being in so many different foods. So thank you. We do have another caller from area code 706. Your line is open.
Hi, it's Jen Padron. Hi, Lauren. Hi, Taya.
Hi, Jen.
Can you hear me?
Hi, Jen.
Can you guys hear me? Hi, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. I just wanted to really call and check out what was going on and what was being talked about. And, I know a lot about coming off psychedelics. But what I'm hearing from you is really a lot more useful about, like, what is helpful during the process. So, that's cool. Thank you for your work.
Thank you, Jen.
You're welcome.
Thanks for sharing the – I saw that you shared the post online. Appreciated that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. So I really support your work. So what are the next steps for you with your work?
Oh, good question. So like I was talking about earlier, I'm trying to see about doing this kind of buddy system program. The other thing that I'm really wanting to do is to guide people through the workbook in my book. So like at the end of each of the 17 chapters, there's a workbook section. And I thought about doing it, in various ways. Like it would be great to do it in person in a group, kind of as we were just talking about, like a support group. But I think that with the focus of these workbook questions, I just feel inspired to do things more with these workbook questions to give people more of a structure, because they're really designed to help people like in a step-by-step way, not only to, to address the practical elements of withdrawal, but also to find like deeper things within themselves about their own process and where they're headed. And I feel like in my book, I kind of feel like these workbook questions are just sort of sitting there, and like maybe people who buy the book are doing them, but overall, I'm not sure if people are really doing them very much. So I've been wanting to facilitate something to support people in actually using those workbook questions.
Yeah. So your book is on Amazon?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I've got a question for you. I'm only on one medication at this point. I've been able to get off of everything else.
How many were you on?
A lot. I think I've been on the entire spectrum of everything over the course of the...
Wow. That's amazing.
I've been taking meds now for about 40 years, a long time.
Wow.
But the one that I'm on that I would like to get off, because it's sticking with my sugar levels, not good, is Abilify, aripiprazole.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels as if it's so ingrained in me biochemically at this point that I get really, really sick, when I have tried to titrate down with the doctor's observations and oversight, which is fine, but it seems almost impossible to get off of. I don't know why.
Yeah,
I wish I could. About 12 years now.
Wow.
About 12 years now, yeah. So do you have any kind of advice on Abilify, please let me know. And it's also one of the largest and quickest newer LAIs out there on the market that people get typically when you go into the hospital in voluntary. It's like, bam, you get an LAI. It's Abilify LAI. So I don't know. It's like this medication is, it's almost like bulletproof to try to get off of. It's weird. It's very strange to me.
I'm not sure with Abilify, but does anyone recommend the possibility of switching over from Abilify to something that's easier to get off of?
Oh, I see what you mean. I've tried to, yes. And I can't give you, I don't recall the names. But that's an interesting idea. And the reason why I'm only on Abilify at this point is because I've been able to titrate off the other ones without any without any sickness or side effects.
Wow, yeah.
And I'm on this because it's, quote, the cleanest med for me, the cleanest at this point with regard to being side effects and everything. But it's hard to get off. It would seem like if I get off this, I could get off of anything.
Yeah.
Seriously. I feel like that. But
have you ever tried
quite a few years to get down to just one?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty impressive that you've gotten down so many. What?
Yeah, I've had to. Have I tried what?
Oh, I was going to ask if you have you ever tried an amino acid supplement, like a supplement that has.
No.
There's one that some people I've worked with have found helpful in the withdrawal symptoms themselves, which is from the company True Hope. They have a specific amino acid supplement that's for withdrawal. So that one might be worth trying because what do you say? Yeah, amino acids.
Yeah, what would that look like?
What would the amino acid look like?
Would it be like what pills, supplements, what or food?
Yeah, it would just be a supplement, like a capsule, I think. Although I'm sure there are other ways you can take it. I mean, the other option that I recommend to some people is protein powder because that's another way to get all the amino acids more quickly absorbed and less likely to, you know, because it's like when we eat things, they might not be fully absorbed if we have any kind of digestive or absorption issues or anything else, or maybe we're not even necessarily eating enough protein. So that's something that can be helpful in withdrawal.
Interesting.
And, you know,
interesting. Yeah. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, keep me posted. You know, there was some research that a doctor at Harvard did about protein powder in benzo withdrawal, but I think it's applicable to, you know, other types of withdrawal, not just benzos, because it is a similar process, you know, of the brain rebalancing. So,
yeah. Cool. Thanks. I'll look into it and see what it's. See what I can do practically on this end, yeah.
Yeah, let me know how it goes.
Yeah,
good
well,
luck.
Thanks.
I hope it works. Yeah, and yeah, the other thing, like I said, is sometimes switching to a drug that's easier to get off of can sometimes, if Abilify is like one of the hardest for you to get off of, then it might help to switch to something easier if that works. You know, I know that it sometimes doesn't always work, but.
Terrific. And
yeah,
again,
that's a good idea.
This is designed to be for informational purposes and not medical advice on any level, but I do think that the more information that we have, the better armed we are for making decisions with informed consent. Kaya, thanks for bringing up Kaya's book on Amazon. I did get it the other day. And it really is terrific. And you have a couple of sections that are so important around informed consent. And then also a section around how psychiatric drugging is a form of violence. That's one of your headings. And so I'm wondering if maybe you can talk a little bit about that. And then we also do have another caller. So I'd like to open up the line for that and see if they're if they wanted to jump in or if they're just listening. So area code 860, your line is open.
Oh, hi. I'm on the only 860?
Yes, hi. Welcome. How are you?
Good. Hi. How do you pronounce your name?
Me?
I know Kaya. Kaya, this is Charlie.
Oh.
Hi, Kaya.
Hi, Charlie.
How are you?
Good to hear from you. Charlie actually came to my book event a couple months ago that was outside in East Hampton. And I know that Charlie works with some people, you know, who are going through psychiatry. I also, Lauren, I wanted to respond to what you had just said briefly. First, I just want to say, like, that being a non-medical consultant gives me a lot of freedom because I never give medical advice. I only share from my experience and the experiences of those that I've worked with, and it's always simply a suggestion, and people are always really totally free to, you know, take it, leave it, do their own research, whatever they choose. So there's no sense of medical advice ever in anything that I say because I'm not even a medical practitioner. But it is like there is some freedom in that because I'm able to support people and give suggestions without having any medical limitations, you know. So I just wanted to say that. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. Can I say something about what you said, Kaya?
Yes. Yes, please.
I think there's like almost like a you know, it kind of makes you cringe when other people are critical of you going into a direction. I try not to like recommend anything directly, but if I know of something, I do tell them, you know, like a supplement or something that might help. It's just that I know what you're saying. It's not really a liability like you're going to get in any lawsuit, right? It's just that professionals don't like, really kind of don't like us doing that, right?
Well, I don't know, Lauren. I'm not sure if you've had the experience of liability issues. I don't know, Lauren, actually exactly what your credentials are in terms of like if you could have liability issues. I mean, obviously anyone can always sue anyone, but I do think it's important to always be very clear, you know, that we don't give medical advice and that we're not medical practitioners if we aren't. Lauren, did you want to say something about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it definitely comes up as a general issue. I think that the word advice was literally used. I think Jen literally asked for advice, and so that was partially what I was responding to. You know, I'm a psychiatric survivor. I'm not a clinical person. I'm a research psychologist. I will not work with people individually. I do systems kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I do think it's really important to continually underscore, especially if people are just tuning in at different points, that that this is not medical advice. That's all.
Yeah, and you know, were you going to say something else?
No.
It's hard not to
okay.
be like in the middle of the medical advice, though, because you're really pulling that apart as you're giving advice, you know. And I love doing that, but it's just that I work with all professional psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers. And, you know, it's kind of hard for me to interject, like, as if I know what I'm talking about when they're so heavily educated and I'm not, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it kind of brings up this dichotomy and this sort of divisiveness in our society that's been fabricated, you know, between those who know, quote unquote, and those who are lay people. But as we all know, like a lot of what doctors and psychiatrists say is also not valid advice, not valid medical advice. It's just that they learned it from a certain system that's been validated by itself, you know. So it's not to say that doctors or psychiatrists even never give any valid medical advice, but a lot of the medical advice they give actually is not valid or accurate and ends up harming people. So it's a little tricky. I mean, I think legally, you know, it's important for us to be clear that we're not medical doctors. But like on a deeper level, you know, the way that it should be is that somebody should always be free to do whatever they want and, you know, whatever information they get from either a doctor or a friend or a consultant or whoever it is like subject to their own research, their own intuition, their own decision as to whether or not they want to follow it.
Yeah, you shouldn't be corralled in.
I think also broadly for the purposes of the show, it's for informational purposes only. And so it's just a reminder to people listening in that you know, any, you know, to do their own research and to make their own choices and to hear conversations, but that there's no suggestion that this is something that is being given as medical advice, right? Because it's not.
Yeah. I guess what I was trying to say is that I think that doctors should probably do that too.
They don't practice real psychology.
The bottom line, though, Kaya, is if there was a doctor that was on the show right now, I would be saying this is not medical advice either. Like, you're not, like,
yeah.
You're going to, like, give somebody medical advice. You have to, like, know that
right.
person, act with that person, be with that person individually. It's
right.
not something that, like, you're broadly listening to 1,000 people and
yeah.
like, giving out some information. I don't think that as a matter of fact, I can say very specifically that whether it was a medical doctor or not, if people started talking about like what other people should or shouldn't do, I would be saying that this wasn't medical advice.
Yeah.
I don't think it has anything to do with the space. I think it's the larger issue of, you know, what is informational versus what is actual guidance for people. So I don't think that guidance could ever broadly be given through any kind of media platform, right?
Right. Oh, completely. Yeah. I mean, even, you know, when people earlier were asking me for advice, I was just speaking in very general terms because I didn't even know, you know, anything about their situation hardly. And like, you can't just listen to somebody, you know, somebody's question and their story for 2 minutes and then give them really good advice, personal advice or anything, obviously. So yeah, I completely agree with you. So even if it were a doctor, you know, they would need to do a lot more diagnostics and listening and really understanding much more of what somebody is experiencing before giving really any advice, whether it's considered medical advice or not, especially if it's supposed to be personalized to that individual.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that like, just to draw the attention back to your book and those sections on informed consent and how there really is no informed consent, and then the other section on how psychiatric drugging, it really is a form of violence. Maybe if you can talk about that for just a couple of minutes to kind of bring people into like this system, that kind of like how people wind up getting in a situation of where they're encountering these drugs in the first place.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Where should I start with that? So yeah, informed consent. I think it's true that with psychiatric medications, it's almost impossible to have real informed consent about them because the entire paradigm of psychiatry is already dishonest. So you can't really have informed consent within a system that, like, it's like even to let's say read or listen to any basic quote unquote facts or information that psychiatry presents, there's really no informed consent because the system itself is like dishonest within itself and is motivated by things other than actually helping people. So the system itself is really motivated by profits in a very large way and uses a lot of dishonesty to reach those profit goals and very successfully. So that's where there's a lack of informed consent. I think that would be the most important piece of the informed consent, is to know what the actual motivations are behind the system of medicine and the way that it's being practiced, which is that the goal of psychiatry is to, you know, make like really, really ridiculous amounts of money at the expense of people's well-being. So like that's the kind of thing that would be informed consent, like for somebody to know that and to know that the diagnoses aren't based on science or biology or you know, any kind of medicine, really. So those are some important elements of informed consent, but those kinds of informed consent would really just discredit the entire system itself.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for that. I think and that's really partially what leads to the violence, right? Your book, you also include this list of 84 capacities that people get from getting off of psychiatry, which I thought was a great list. Do you want to just talk about like for the bright spots of like when people have come through the other side that you've worked with and now are in a place of where they've passed the withdrawal and they're operating without the dependence on the psychiatric drugs? What really happens for people and what happened for yourself most importantly?
Okay. Yeah, I definitely answer that. I think I will say like that this could be the last question because I would like to end it pretty soon. That's okay. Okay, cool. So yeah, that's a good thing to end on too, like a positive note. What people often when they are getting off psychiatric drugs or when they're finished getting off of them, there's often like a sense of rebirth and coming back to life and getting one's creativity back, getting energy back, feeling a sense of connectedness with oneself and other people again, being able to rewrite one's story or re-understand or re-narrate one's story, whether they're a writer or not, but being able to have a different understanding of what happened and more clarity. For myself, it was like a very intense sort of death and rebirth kind of experience because I lost so much of my health. And that's what that section 84 capacities that returned to me after I got off psychiatric drugs. That was a list, you know, of all the things that I could think of when I wrote it that had come back to me that I had lost while I was on them. So, you know, things like creativity, physical strength and stamina, like being able to eat normal, I shouldn't say normal, but being able to eat a variety of foods. When I was on those medications, I had a very limited diet. So those are just some, but, you know, being able to relate with people in a way that felt connective again, just feeling like myself again. And I guess those are the things that are coming into my mind, but things like, go ahead. I guess that's all, but you know, you can check out that section of the book, or I even have that online on my website, and you know, this 84 capacities that returned to me when I came off psychiatric meds. I even have a video on YouTube about it. If you Google that line, you know, 84 capacities that returned to me when I got off psychiatric drugs, you'll find it. So if you want more, you know, more inspiration or hope, that list can be good. You know, and other people I've worked with have gotten off of these drugs after many, many years, like some people after 40 or 50 years even. And like it can really be like this renaissance with one's own creativity and self-expression.
Oh, Kaya, thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight and for everybody who called in. We've been talking with Kaya Grossberg, author of Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs, who is a alternative to psychiatry consulting. You can find Kaya on her website at kayagrossberg.com. I hope you will give us updates about what you're talking about creating these peer buddy systems and other work that you're doing as you're going forward. Thank you so much again. I find your book to be very valuable, and I encourage people to go to Amazon and pick it up. Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs, Kaya Grossberg. Tonight, December 22nd, 2021. If you'd like to be a guest on Talk with Tenny, please give me a call at area code 516-319-4295. Until next time.
Thank you so much, Lauren. It was so great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks, Kaya.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. Have a great night. Look forward to hearing more from you. Bye-bye.
Have a nice one.
Thanks, everybody. Check out Mental American Monster, The Sprawl of American Psychiatry, and other projects that are being worked on. We also have a conference that's coming up on aging in the movement and in the world. If you are interested in submitting a proposal for that, please contact me. We are looking for, first, of course, we've lost so many leaders of our movement in recent times. And so we're looking for ways to memorialize people's lives and work and to catalog their work. We also want to be doing interviews with people who are still with us to preserve your work in your own voices. And then materials around advanced directives, living wills, how to archive papers, and importantly, how to escape psychiatry in later life. Again, thanks everybody for tuning in. You can reach me at 516-319-4295. Until next time, you don't have to be mad to call in, but it helps.